Hello, my name is Dave Emery. In the next half hour segment, we're going to once again develop upon not Princess Diana's death. And again, I cannot state definitively that it was not some sort of conspiracy. There's been all kinds of discussion of that on the internet and elsewhere. And indeed, I've been asked all kinds of questions about that. And on the balance, first of all, I think the official versions advanced by, among others, Muammar Gaddafi, or the conspiratorial versions, the notion of the British family had Diana killed, is ridiculous. In the British royal family, they have much more discreet ways of settling differences than murder. It was one thing in Henry VIII's time, but they're a little more circumspect about such things right now. And indeed, I don't think the circumstances suggest a hit. If what we've been told is correct, and if, in fact, the driver had three times the legal limit of alcohol in his blood and was driving 110 miles an hour, that'll do it, folks. And again, at an executive-level hit, things are not left to chance. And if Diana had been wearing a seatbelt, she'd still be alive. It does not suggest any sort of hit, although, as I indicated in the previous half-hour segment about the death of Johnny Versace, I do think that it is important to read the news with a critical and intelligent eye to understand what people in Europe and elsewhere in the world understand, which is that our media are censored. We do not have a free press. It's not completely restricted, but it is definitely spin-controlled, as they say, and it's something that people should definitely understand. I thought, by way of focusing on a political scientific aspect of the world we live in as it applies to the British royal family, that does not get the discussion that the vulgar treatment of Princess Diana's life and death has gotten. I thought that some of the connections of the British royal family to the forces of international fascism that I focus on in this program might be worth touching on. Now, in other broadcasts, such as the two-hour interview with John Loftus, the author of The Belarus Secret and The Secret War Against the Jews, that latter co-authored with Mark Ahrens. We've discussed the Duke of Windsor and his profound connections to Adolf Hitler. He was a sympathizer of Adolf Hitler, and in fact, British intelligence had their hands full trying to keep him in line. That was one of the reasons why he abdicated the throne. It was not really his marriage, his potential marriage to Wallace Simpson, an American commoner. In fact, the Duke of Windsor's connections to the Third Reich were by no means the only connections that in-laws or members of the British royal family had to the Third Reich. And I thought, just by way of focusing on or highlighting what it is that people pay attention to, namely, leggy blonde women, rather than important political connections, I thought we'd jump back in time, and we're going to listen to a portion of the One Step Beyond program from April 21st, 1985, 12 and a half years ago. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air duties. This, again, is excerpted from One Step Beyond of April 21st, 1985.
We'll be talking about that. Of course, one of the other major stories that came out this week, and it's not gotten as much play in the United States as in England, where it was front page headline news, you know, 8-inch banner headlines, et cetera, et cetera, which is the fact that a death's head, as a matter of fact, has been found in the British royal family's closet. We're going to read a short segment of an article from the New York Times for Thursday, April 18th, 1965. The headline is, "Swastika's Shadow Falls Over the Royal Family." Okay, this is by R.W. Apple, Jr., as a special to the New York Times, Dateline, London. Princess Michael of Kent, who is married to a cousin of Queen Elizabeth II, spoke today of her, quote, deep shame at discovering that her father had been a member of the SS under Hitler. But she said she would soon prove that his affiliation had been honorary in nature and that he had been exonerated after World War II. Her statement, made in an interview on breakfast television, failed to still the controversy that has preoccupied the British press, if not the general public, since the report became known here on Sunday night when it was first published by the Daily Mirror. Simon Wiesenthal, the Nazi hunter, immediately said that the princess's father, Baron Gunther von Reibnitz, must have played an active role in the SS in order to have attained his wartime rank of major. Okay, before I skip down, also bear in mind that one of the great controversies over Ronald Reagan's visit to Bitburg Cemetery is that there are members, reportedly, some 30 members, I believe, of the Waffen-SS, which is the military arm of the SS, buried in the Bitburg Cemetery. Skipping on down, Princess Michael was born Marie Christine von Reibnitz near what is now Karlovy Vary, Czechoslovakia, in the dying days of World War II, and her parents separated shortly afterward. She was taken to Australia by her mother, raised there, and never met her father until she went to spend a year with him in Mozambique, where he had settled when she was 18. The Baron, who has since died, attended her wedding in Vienna in 1978. She insisted in the television interview that although she knew her father had been a Nazi, she had always thought that he joined the party in self-protection, as did many other Germans. But when the newspaper article appeared, she said, she telephoned her mother in Australia and was told that he had indeed been a member of the SS, the Nazi elite guard. Quote, "Here I am, 40 years old," the princess said, "and I discover something that is really quite unpleasant. I shall just simply have to learn to live with it." The princess also spoke of a document that she said would prove that her father had been officially cleared of involvement in the Nazi concentration camps, and said he had never worn an SS uniform. One of her close friends, Norman St. John Stavis, a conservative member of parliament, said the document was issued by a Bavarian denazification tribunal in 1948 and classed the Baron as a, quote, minor Nazi official. Mr. Wiesenthal said by telephone from Vienna that he doubted that Baron von Reibnitz had taken any part in Nazi atrocities because, quote, it was not Hitler's policy to have the aristocracy involved in the camps, unquote. But he dismissed as, quote, absolutely unbelievable, Princess Michael's comment about the Baron's merely honorary rank in the SS. It is still unclear whether Buckingham Palace had known before this weekend of Baron von Reibnitz's past. Ordinarily, anyone planning to marry into the royal family is thoroughly investigated, because the Queen must by law give her approval, and there is no suggestion that this step was omitted in the case of the princess. Australian journalists say that the whole story was known there during her youth, and that British official investigators must surely have learned of it. Some critics have suggested that the palace knew and covered up. Others have insisted that the security services, which have often been criticized for failing to root out spies, had bungled another job. According to documents unearthed by journalists and researchers, Baron von Reibnitz joined the Nazis in 1930 and became a friend of Hitler's right-hand man, Hermann Göring. He married the princess's mother, the daughter of an Austrian ambassador to Russia in 1941, and spent much of the war on the staff of the SS Southeast District with headquarters at Breslau in Silesia, which is now Wrocław, Poland. Some records suggest that he was dismissed from the SS in 1944 and was sent to the Russian front.
Well, the death's heads, I guess one could say, in the royal closet are going to grow more numerous here and perhaps more significant. One of the things that we've been talking about and which would be worth reflecting on in, I guess you could say, against the background of Ronald Reagan's proposed trip to the Bitburg Cemetery, which does not only contain the graves of some SS men, but also Bitburg was a staging area for a key SS unit which spearheaded the Battle of the Bulge, the German Ardennes offensive. One of the people who was involved in that was a very mysterious SS general named Fritz Kramer, who apparently did not exist, at least according to records, before 1939, and apparently disappeared from the face of the earth after 1947. He was chief of staff of the 6th SS Panzer Army. There was also an interesting Fritz Kramer who apparently was connected to IG Farben and yet was anti-Nazi and working on behalf of the U.S. Intelligence Service and in the U.S. Army. He also was at the Battle of the Bulge, and one of the people he was in contact with was a young private named Henry Kissinger. A fellow named William Casey, an OSS officer, was at the Battle of the Bulge. So that is a very key area. And in connection with the massacre of a number of American POWs at Malmedy, right across the border from Bitburg, there was an interesting trial in which Fritz Kramer, chief of staff of the 6th SS Panzer Army, stood trial for this massacre, and his acquittal or his conviction and sentenced to 10 years, later commuted at that trial in 1947, is the last record of this fellow. Now, this Fritz Kramer, who was associated with Henry Kissinger, goes on to become the chief of operations and plans for the Pentagon, I believe, starting in 1949. And as one biographer of Henry Kissinger put it, every thought Kissinger ever had was, quote, pure Kramer, unquote. Now, May Brussel has raised the question of whether or not there might be some connection between these two Fritz Kramers, if in fact they might in fact be the same person, and what was this one Fritz Kramer doing, if they're the same, switching back and forth between the two armies. And that's one of the interesting things that looms in the background of Ronald Reagan's upcoming trip, particularly in light of the fact that Henry Kissinger was the Well, how would you put it? Sort of the czar, the overseer of a bipartisan commission to sort of establish the current course of the administration's Central American policy. And his connections and other connections of the Reagan administration to the Third Reich and to the SS in particular are things we've focused on in the past on this broadcast. And so as you reflect on the connections between the British royal family and the SS, keep in mind that there are some connections between this self-same organization and the current administration in this country, and that's very much in the background of this this whole situation vis-a-vis his trip to Bitburg, his initial refusal to go to Dachau, and so forth. Also, interestingly enough, Baron von Reibnitz was stationed in the Breslau area, which was a part of formerly Germany, initially East Prussia, which is now part of Poland. That's also the hometown of both Galen and Otto von Bolschwing.
And, of course, we have talked at some length about both of these gentlemen. To make it quick for the new listeners, Reinhard Galen was the head of Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Service, who jumped immediately to the Americans before the war was even really over, promptly was made the head of the CIA's brand new Eastern Front operation, and he transplanted his entire Nazi intelligence operation onto the CIA with barely a crack or seam, later went on to become the head of NATO intelligence and eventually formed the BND, which is the West German CIA. Otto von Bolschwing, we've talked about also. Otto von Bolschwing was an SD man, an SS intelligence man. He was involved in all kinds of things, including the resettlement of Jews in Palestine. Later rumored to have been the head of the Galen organization in North America, and himself was head of a Silicon Valley technology company until his death about 2 years ago, and himself a man with many odd connections that we have delved into in the past.
Okay, now another SS man turned up in the royal closet, another death's head in the closet, so to speak. This one reported about in today's San Francisco Sunday Examiner, today being April 21st, an AP story, Dateline London headline, New Tales of Nazis in Royal Family. A brother-in-law of Prince Philip, Queen Elizabeth II's husband, was a high-ranking officer in the SS, London newspapers said today. In new reports of links between the elite Nazi unit and members of the royal family, the Sunday Times and the Mail today identified the officer as Prince Christoph of Hesse, who married Prince Philip's sister Sophie in 1930. Prince Christoph was killed in an air crash in 1943 after reaching a rank senior to a colonel and, quote, was a close aide of Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS and the Gestapo, the Sunday Times said. The reports follow Tuesday's disclosure by the Daily Mirror that the wife of the Queen's first cousin, Prince Michael, is the daughter of the late Baron Günther von Reibnitz, an SS officer who joined the Nazi Party before Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933. Buckingham Palace refused to comment on the reports. The Sunday Times said that Prince Christoph was the head of an espionage network during the 1930s that gathered intelligence for the Nazis. It said the network helped Hitler prepare for the 1939 invasion of Czechoslovakia and to deceive British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who thought he had gained a lasting peace in negotiations with Hitler at Munich the previous year. The Sunday Times said it had interviewed Prince Christoph's son, Prince Rainer, or I don't know how it's pronounced, R-A-I-N-E-R, Rainer of Hesse, a cousin of Prince Charles, heir to the British throne. Prince Rainer, quote, confirmed that the Hesse family was close to Hitler and received preferential treatment, unquote, the newspaper said. So, apparently, at least two in-laws of the British royal family were connected to the SS, and one apparently to an espionage ring, which apparently took several different steps to try and sort of pave the Nazis' road to conquest. Of course, the connections between Neville Chamberlain and a fellow named Montague Norman, who was head of the Bank of England, and Norman's connections to Hitler is something we talked about in our Radio Free America show number one.
Okay, now I'm going to read you one more rather interesting article on the British upper crust, the aristocracy and the government of Britain, and then I'm going to draw together some rather far-ranging things together and see if I can't make some sense out of them for you, or at least for myself. Okay, this is from a January 2nd, 1985 article from the Daily Times of London. Okay, thanks to Mae Brussel for this. This is headlined, Gag on Hitler's Will. Okay, in quotes, will. It's by Alan Copps. It says, publication of a document described as Hitler's, quote, last political will was opposed by the 1954 British cabinet, which feared that the Führer's vision for Europe's future coincided too closely with its own policy towards Germany. Lord Simons, the Lord Chancellor, advised, quote, there is some risk of foolish talk to the effect that our German policy is to do just what Hitler and Ribbentrop wanted or professed to want, unquote. However, he ruled out legal action and recommended persuasion to prevent publication of the views which were contained in a letter from von Ribbentrop, the former German foreign minister, addressed to Mr. Churchill, Prime Minister, and Mr. Eden, Foreign Secretary. The advice was given at a time when the Churchill government was anxious to support Chancellor Adenauer's attempt to put West Germany back on its economic feet. Let me just insert into the middle of this article here that, again, those of you who listen to Radio Free America broadcasts, and also just our regular broadcast here, will be aware of the fact that under Adenauer, that the Western governments basically absolutely undid any process of denazification and, in fact, injected huge quantities of Nazis right back into the West German system.
And Adenauer himself had hard connections, sympathetic connections to the Third Reich, which we talked about in that broadcast.
Indeed, and the man who was, I guess you would say, the equivalent to Adenauer that Ed Meese was until he became Attorney General to Ronald Reagan, in other words, his chief personal advisor, a man named Hans Globke, was the man who actually authored the Nazi racial laws. The man who signed that document was hanged after being convicted at Nuremberg, and yet Globke returned into a position of power. Let's get going on with the article. The advice was given at a time when the Churchill government was anxious to support Chancellor Adenauer's attempt to put West Germany back on its economic feet. The Ribbentrop letter, although undated, had first been received in London on June 17, 1945, just 3 days after the former foreign minister had been captured by British troops in Hamburg. After standing trial at Nuremberg, he was eventually hanged in October of 1946. In 1945, on Mr. Churchill's instructions, copies of the letter were sent to Stalin and President Truman, and it was circulated to the cabinet. But although its existence became known to the press, its contents were kept secret, as Ribbentrop had requested. However, a full five-page version, together with a four-line covering letter addressed to Field Marshal Montgomery, appears in the Prime Minister's papers, released under the 30-year rule. Although rambling in tone and full of self-justificatory statements from Ribbentrop, the essence of the letter is summed up in the passage, quote, in spite of all disappointment and embitterment about the repeated English rejection of the German offers, the English-German collaboration has, to his last hour, always been the political creed of the Führer, unquote. It concludes, the war is lost for Germany. In spite of this fact, I am of the holy conviction that the bringing about of a real friendship between the English and the German people is a fundamental necessity. The Führer was not of the same opinion and has therefore entrusted me to inform you.
Now, one of the things that stands astride the entire broadcast that we're doing here, God bless, is to be found, if not at the root, very close to the root, and in most cases very precisely at the root, of the presence of not only Nazi, vehement Nazi luminaries, such as these SS men we've been talking about, these SS officers, not only connected to the royal family and connected to our own presidency, but also, of course, to our intelligence administration. The connections between a great many industrial organizations in this country and industrial organizations in Nazi Germany was also to be explained by the same motive, namely anti-communism, both This really is something which can't be separated from these connections we're talking about. And before we move on here, that the similarity between Hitler's will and Germany's post-war policy with regard to Germany and the presence of these SS men in the closet, so to speak, of the royal family, and the vehement anti-communism held by many people are very much at one.
Okay, now a couple of things again to put this in perspective and to take this out of the realm of late night World War II movies, you know, and the evil of the Nazis versus the good of the Allies, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, one of the main reasons that there were these connections, say, between the British royal family, that there were connections between the plans of the Nazis and, the eventual route that West Germany took when the Allies began to administrate West Germany, the fact that Klaus Barbie is sitting in a French jail where he will probably sit until he dies because reputedly there are many, many people still in positions of power in France who are very embarrassed over the collaboration, which was massive, with the Nazis during the Nazi occupation. All these things and more suggest that if you to strip the word Nazism away, whether you call it fascism, whatever you call it, the reason that it is still such a force in the world today and that it still resonates so strongly is because of the very, very strong sympathy that many people felt in positions of power, and especially those who felt they had things to protect from the great mass of people, felt then and still feel today with the fascist way of political thought. Now, this is important for a variety of reasons, not just the cosmetic stuff of Ronald Reagan going or not going to an SS cemetery or a cemetery with SS bodies in it, because if you really want to, that you can dismiss that as being poor PR or whatever it is. In other words, it's possible it signifies Ronald Reagan's deep underlying philosophy of things. It's possible it doesn't, and it's just bad PR work by his advance teams. However, what we do have to look at is that the very fact that at the same time that this is going on, okay, we have Ronald Reagan demanding the Congress essentially give him money to fund a private army of mercenaries and ex-fascist National Guardsmen, largely, who are fighting the elected and world-recognized government of Nicaragua, and with the express aim of overthrowing that government solely because it is Marxist. And I don't think any reasonable observer, regardless of whether they agree with Ronald Reagan or not, could argue with the fact that that's the only reason, that the exporting revolution argument and all that other is a bunch of crap. Okay, on the other hand, though, we are continuing friendly relations and, in fact, still shipping weaponry and all kinds of other aid to the government of Guatemala, for instance, which is slaughtering its own people by the thousands, which nobody has accused Nicaragua of. I mean, not any responsible government or party has accused the government of Nicaragua. So what we're looking at is not, you know, the fact of whether Ronald Reagan likes Nazis or doesn't, but the fact that anti-communism or the call of anti-communism is so strong and is, you know, it may be covering up for deeper, darker motives, quite possibly, but that there is no longer any sense of right versus wrong. I mean, hypocrisy has gone by the boards. This is beyond hypocrisy. This is bordering on political insanity. And we're talking about a government that is calling the Soviet Union the focus of all evil on earth. At the same time, they're trying to basically rehabilitate the Nazis. They have rehabilitated or been party to the rehabilitation of fascists of all shapes and stripes, Guatemala and Chile, among others. At the same time, they're trying to crush legitimate governments in Nicaragua and other places. So this is why this is current and this is happening. This is not 40 years in the past.
I would also say that whether you're looking at the Contras and their war against the Sandinista government or the government of Guatemala, the role of the Green Berets in U.S. counterinsurgency operations and techniques and their origins with regard to the SS, something we've talked about again on our Radio Free America shows. You'll hear about it on Mae Brussels' World Watchers broadcasts. These SS intelligence connections are front and center there as well. Also recall a few weeks ago we looked at the Reagan administration's significant weakening of a U.S. government suit against the National Alliance, which is one of the Nazi groups connected with the Aryan Nations that we're going to talk about in the second part of the broadcast. And the administration essentially weakened a suit which would have denied them tax-exempt status, along with the parochial schools that Reagan wants to grant tax-exempt status to as well.
Again, bear in mind the Reagan administration, at the same time that the government of South Africa is being revealed to have had policemen who, without any prompting whatsoever, and in no way, even the policemen admit, in no way fearing for their own safety, shot 17 out of 20 dead demonstrators in the back at Uitenhage in South Africa. At the same time, the government of Nicaragua and the Soviet Union are becoming the focus of evil on earth. So what we're talking about here is the language is being stretched and warped to the point where it no longer is a useful tool anymore for discussing political matters. And this is the key. This is what the key is, and this is why you want to follow these things so closely, because at a certain point, the normal give and take of political ideas becomes warped beyond the ability to use them as tools anymore. And when you start talking about responsibility, political responsibility and debate, and you're talking about a government that flat out lies, like Ronald Reagan just lied about the Pope giving him the support for Latin American policy, and when Ronald Reagan says that nobody in Germany was alive who knew what was going on during World War II, I mean, this is lunacy, folks. This is not political debate. The word has lost its meaning.
Well, yeah, and before moving on here, just remember the bottom line with regard to apartheid, in as far as American policy is concerned, is Jonestown. Okay, there is an end to apartheid for you. Again, talking about Nazi connections to royal families, and bear in mind that even though monarchy as a system of government is pretty much out, many of these royal families not only have a lot of connections but a lot of money as well, and money, particularly in large quantities of it, translates very directly into political power, okay? Talking about SS connections to royal families, some that bridges the gap between these royal families and some of the transatlantic Nazi U.S. industrial connections that we've been talking about is a fellow named Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, when Queen Juliana, who at one point was considered the richest woman in the world due to her holdings in Royal Dutch Shell Oil, when she was Queen of the Netherlands, her husband, Prince Bernhard, was, obviously he was her husband, he was the man of the royal family, I guess you could say, in Netherlands, and he also was a major in the SS. Beyond that, he was a spy with something called the Berlin NW7 office of IG Farben, the giant chemical cartel which provided the backbone of German war production and was an important instrument of Nazi economic policy and foreign espionage as well. Now, Prince Bernhard's role as not only the Prince of the Netherlands, but also as an SS major and as an industrial spy for IG Farben was covered in a book called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. That book was authored by a former Hoover scholar, a scholar at the Hoover Institute right here in right down the road in Palo Alto, named Anthony C. Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N. And the hardcover edition of his Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, published by the 76 Press in 1976, copyrighted 1976, writing of Prince Bernhard. The Berlin NW7 office of IG Farben was the key Nazi overseas espionage center. The unit operated under Farben director Max Ilgner, nephew of IG Farben president Hermann Schmitz. Max Ilgner, and that's I-L-G-N-E-R, and Hermann Schmitz were on the board of American IG with fellow directors Henry Ford of Ford Motor Company, Paul Warburg of the Bank of Manhattan, and Charles E. Mitchell of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The so-called Statistics Department of NW7, and known as VOWI, was created in 1929 and evolved into the economic intelligence arm of the Wehrmacht. At the outbreak of war in 1939, VOWI employees were ordered into the Wehrmacht, but in fact continued to perform the same work as when nominally under IG Farben. One of the more prominent of these Farben intelligence workers in NW7 was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who joined Farben in the early 1930s after completion of an 18-month period of service in the black uniformed SS. So recall that his work as an IG Farben employee was essentially coterminous with his work as a Wehrmacht spy and former SS man. And his role in perhaps subverting the Dutch resistance is something we'll talk about in our Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast on May 26th.
That concludes a rebroadcast of the One Step Beyond program from April 21st of 1985, or a portion thereof. You heard the reference to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program that was aired on May 26th, the rebroadcast on May 26th of 1985. That program, like many of the other archive shows documenting the Western industrial connections to fascism, are available. That program and others are available from Spitfire, again, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email address ALCALAME, that's ALCALAME, at ix.netcom.com. A list of all of those programs is available on the KFJC webpage. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. Again, that's www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs section. And that concludes this particular half-hour segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.